What is good, everyone? This is season 3, episode 22. And we're going to talk about something different on this episode that does deal with what the enemy has done, but we're not going to talk about the list of ways that the enemy thinks and acts. We're going to go on that in the next episode. Even though I said this episode we were going to talk about the next. But for this one, we're going to talk about how the United States is a corporation. And why that's remotely important. Well, for starters, the U.S. corporation is under Title 28 of the United States Code, Section 3002, Subsection 15, Subsection A. United States means a federal corporation. Why is that important to know that? Well, it's under Chapter 176, which is Federal Debt Collection Procedure. That's under the definitions for it. What is so important about the U.S. corporation? And why isn't anyone in the media talking about it? Well, you see, in the United States, you have what's called the state national movement that knows that the United States is a corporation. Very far and few between those that are not in the state national movement know that the U.S. is a corporation. But of course, the media is not going to talk about it because they are the U.S. corporation. It's corporations under the U.S. corporation. Well, what makes the U.S. corporation so detrimental to what we do and how things run in the world? Well, you have, in Russia, different jurisdictions that are under what are called a state corporation. Okay? In the majority of countries, the government you are abiding by, to an extent, is more than likely a corporation. Because that is how a government is able to take on debt. It's having it as a corporation. That's why you have a president of a corporation, and a vice president of a corporation. So whatever world that you, or part of the world that you live in, you know, unless you've been living under a rock, which I hope you're not, a corporation has a president, it has a vice president, it has a secretary, it has a treasurer, it has a board of directors, which would be like the senators. But yes, Title 28 of the United States Code, Section 3002, Subsection 15, United States means Subsection A, a federal corporation. All right. And I'm going to talk more about this and the importance of how we got there, as well as its use today, and where we're headed. And I'm going to point out different United States codes that also speak about U.S. citizen is a corporation. So let's go ahead and get into it. All right, so there are a few things we're going to go over. And some of these are going to be also Supreme Court cases in America, of course. So what I'm speaking of is, yeah, it's geared towards people in the United States, but it doesn't mean that there is no relevance to other countries. You'll have something similar, not to the exact same methods, because you have, for example, those in Europe are under parliament, or you have a democracy in another country that has their system ran a bit different than the way America runs their so-called democracy. And so I want to point out that America is not a republic. It is a democracy because of the United States Corporation. The United States Corporation is ran by the creditors. That is based on the de facto jurisdiction. And the de jure jurisdiction is where the republic for the United States of America is. So yes, so when people say, oh, America is a republic, they're correct to an extent, they're just incorrect in to their knowledge of it. So, which America are people referring to? They usually want to refer to the one that's not the corporation because they just don't know that it is a corporation to begin with. But they don't understand that they're not in the republic. They're not in the de jure jurisdiction. They're in the de facto jurisdiction under the United States Corporation. And so that's why you're going to have the majority of countries in the world that are affected by the dollar and affected by the United States because of the dollar. But let's go ahead and move forward a bit, because I have talked about some things before, so I'm not going to mention some things that I already have. For example, like the Constitution/Declaration of Independence. Though that being created, there are two constitutions. That one, okay, that one which was with the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution formalized in 1781, you have the U.S. Corporation then created in 1861 with the Act of 1871 formalized with the creation of Washington, D.C. for the U.S. Corporation to be created. So, without further ado, we have the Supreme Court cases and why United States citizens are debt slaves without rights and no life and owe permanent allegiance to the U.S. Corporation. And those who have a concern about, look at what's happening to our country. Well, no, you're not looking at what's happening to your country. You're looking at what's happening to the corporation. You have every right to have concern because you are connected to that. And everything you have built up in there is going to be destroyed. Now, unless, like, for example, you have tangible assets, some of those are still going to be in the de facto jurisdiction. So, like, for example, if you hold title to real estate, yeah, the value of that is going to be absolutely zero when the system collapses. However, here's the other thing, too. If you don't hold ownership of the land, then you're not even going to have that property anymore. But let's go ahead and get into these Supreme Court cases. Starting with Marbury versus Madison on February 24th, 1803. All right, the entirety of this is that, and by the way, I did not look into putting all these Supreme Court cases together, the majority of them I found from someone else that put together that information on a TikTok. I cannot remember this individual's name, or excuse me, I cannot remember this man's name, but I saw his TikTok, which was like a minute, and it was great how he set it up. But I give him credit for most of these that he put together. You have Marbury versus Madison, which is February 24th, 1803. The Constitution is made worthless, and the Supreme Court takes power. After that, you have Titles of Nobility Amendments, which is May 1st, 1810, where you strip your citizenship and you replace it as being a foreign noble, where you are awarded the fullest protection by Title 18 of the United States Code, Sections 112 and 1116, which were those. The United States Code wasn't created until after. It was created during the 20th century, okay? But it wasn't created in the 19th century. But those laws were still then in effect to an extent the way that it was done. So yes, strip your citizenship to become a noble from a foreign country, you get the fullest protection. Minus being a secured creditor. Martin versus Hunter Lisi, March 20th, 1816. You have Supreme Court can only hear cases about civil liberties / Bill of Rights. So now we're starting to get into the point of people can't really do what they want to discuss between themselves. It has to be dealt with at the Supreme Court. Then you have John Brown on December 2nd, 1859. He starts the Civil War in 1859 as a slave rebellion. I haven't done full in-depth research on this, but either way, it's what helped the Rothschilds start the Civil War. And as a sneak peek on the next season, we're going to talk about the Black Nobility, which were the satanic bloodlines before the current bloodlines that are out today. Moving on. All right, so Abraham Lincoln actually was not good. He was a traitor. He was a Rosicrucian. He was also a lawyer for big business and the bankers in Chicago. And when he was president, he legalized slavery via the 13th Amendment in 1865 and classified it as a U.S. citizen in the 14th Amendment in 1868. And you have the Act of 1871, which is what I mentioned as the U.S. Corporation. This is where Congress commits treason behind closed doors with international bankers to create corporate governance, such as Title 28, the U.S. Code, Section 3002. In rapid succession, though, from 1869 to 1934 were acts by the 41st Congress, which is between 1861 to 1871, up to the 73rd Congress, which was between 1933 to 1934. That devalued money, which is gold and silver that was used, to be stolen from the American people. All right, so let's get back into the Supreme Court cases. You have U.S. versus Cruikshank. On March 27th, 1876, ends the First Amendment right to life. The Bar, British Accredited Registry, was created and established in Massachusetts on August 21st, 1885. So we never had a legal system before 1885, nor even when the U.S. Corporation was created as well. There was no such thing as a legal system ever in this country when it was founded, even for roughly 100 years, give or take. little more than 100 years. So having the bar established in Massachusetts in 1885 proves we don't need a legal system. It's a farce. Because whether, okay, and I'm not saying that every single lawyer slash attorney out there are bad people. What I am saying is that whether you are there to actually help people as an attorney slash lawyer, you are a soldier for the international bankers. And your allegiance is to the court. That is the only allegiance that they have. Now, and to the bar. That's not to say that there aren't lawyers and attorneys out there wanting to help people. And they are needed for the de facto jurisdiction, but for the de facto jurisdiction only. Because there's certain things people can't do that you need an attorney for, such as securities law, such as asset protection for legal entities. You don't need a lawyer or an attorney to create a trust. Sometimes you do, depending on the situation. Most of the time, you don't. But when it comes to building like a corporation or an LLC, you need someone who has their niche in asset protection to do that for you. So there's a couple examples why you need a lawyer slash an attorney. Unless you know that stuff yourself and you've corrected your status, that's completely different in America. Okay. But most of the time, people that just don't study that stuff, but they know how to do, they know how to read the law, know how to use it, you still will need those people to help you what you're doing. Then, of course, we have President William McKinley was assassinated by the Rothschilds on September 14th, 1901, because he was suing them in court for securities fraud. By the way, William McKinley, he actually was one of them at one point, and he was part of what's called the Whig Party, which was actually for creating a central bank, but was against Freemasonry. Yeah, the Whig Party was just an odd thing. Anti-Freemasonry movement was a movement where someone who was a part of the Freemasons was going to expose it and then was killed by them. That's how the anti-Freemason movement began. But that merged in with the Whig Party, as the Whig Party was for a central bank. So, you know, kind of had your pros and cons to the Whig Party. So, he knew about those things. And that's one of the reasons why he was going after the Russians. Then you have the 17th Amendment on April 8th, 1913. Is ratified, so that way Congress can be voted in. And I do want to mention real quickly about Chas M. Higgins. Okay, he wrote a book called Horrors of Vaccination. Well, it was technically a petition, because that's how he said it. This is a petition to President Woodrow Wilson in 1920, but called Horrors of Vaccination because of compulsory vaccination that was being imposed upon the people. So people think that vaccine mandate is something new today. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Vaccination is just a way to destroy the God genome, to separating the DNA and mRNA from our creator. But yeah, just wanted to point that out. But moving on to Carroll versus U.S., hence United States Corporation, on March 2nd, 1925, this is during the Prohibition era, it creates exigent circumstances. 1, loss of life. 2, hot pursuit. 3, seize evidence. This means police officers in hot pursuit of citizens, like landowners running after their slaves. And this is because during the alcohol prohibition era, the FBI poisons the alcohol. The FBI was never, ever, ever for us. Now, if you remember back when I talked about with the Rockefeller family, how they started it was for human trafficking. Well, it was also to poison the alcohol. And so that way they could make it illegal. So that way they could make a huge profit in the underworld. But we have Olmstead versus U.S. June 4th, 1928. An unjust conviction upheld by President Taft. If you remember with the Russell bloodline that I spoke of, he's from there. Who was a Supreme Court justice at the time, as the prison system is also created during this time so as not to execute certain people, such as the Satanic Elite and the bloodlines. And the prison system is debtor's prison. So yes, you can get anyone out of prison. You know, granted, we don't want everyone out of prison. We don't want axe murderers and serial killers and rapists and pedophiles and so forth running amok in the streets. No, we don't want that. But those who don't belong in prison or jail, they can all get released because it's based on the financial system. Now, I've already talked a bit about the Vatican and the Rockefeller family, of course, but with the Federal Reserve, all right, it was established in 1933 via the House Joint Resolution 192, Public Law 73-10. The secret meeting was held in 1913, but it wasn't formally established until 1933. This is so it creates the debt slave. As the U.S. corporation went bankrupt, so the U.S. corporation did a Chapter 13. They reorganized so that way it creates the Federal Reserve. So the public is lied to turn in all their gold for dollars, so that way in 1936, they have the Social Security Act, so that way they lie to the people saying, hey, we need to back up these dollars. They're not dollars, it's debt, because it says Federal Reserve Note. Note in banking terms means debt. So people are like, yeah, we'll back up our labor for your bankrupt corporation, even though that's what they didn't know it was about. But instead, the whole point was that the people are actually the creditors. So you actually use the credit system from the Federal Reserve, which is backed up by the wealth of the world, the wealth that's stolen by the enemy. So you use that credit to then pay for goods and services out in the public. And the reason for the Federal Reserve notes is because the note is saying, hey, here's my note for the time being because my credit is good. So once you receive that credit, this note you need to get rid of. So Title 12, the United States Code, Section 411 is created, changing legal tender into lawful money. So December 23rd, 1913. Is so that way you are able to exchange the legal tender, the Federal Reserve Note, in for lawful money. Then moving forward from the 1940s to the 1960s, I'm not going to talk about the War of the Worlds radio broadcast, because we're not talking about the fake alien invasion on this episode. We're talking about the U.S. corporation. But from the 1940s to the 1960s is the rise of corporate America. Okay, so on June 10th, 1968, you have Terry versus Ohio. It takes away the amendments, the people's liberty. You also have, before then, October 14th, 1940, it's also created, Title 8 in the United States Code, Section 1101, Subsection 22, Subsection B defines one as a national of the United States, thereby now classifying three classes in the U.S. The citizen, which is the debt slave. You have the national, which is owing permanent allegiance. Excuse me, there's four classes. You have foreign noble, immune from harm in the legal system, as well as the secured creditor. Then we're going to pause right here and we're going to come back to this awesome content. So stay tuned. Welcome back, everyone. We are going to continue on this U.S. corporation and things associated with it. Now, I have here a list of things, and I did go through some of this. Some of it is correct, some of it isn't. So just bear with me on this one. However, let's get moving forward. But this one is called Truthful Facts People Should Know, But Most Do Not. The IRS is not a U.S. government agency. It is an agency of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. Which is true. Okay, that is correct. Another one that is also correct is the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, is an agency of the UN. And you can find that in Black's Law Dictionary, 6th edition, page 816. The United States has not had a treasury since 1921. That's not correct because U.S. Treasury has not had, or the U.S. United States has not had a treasury since 1920 because the transfer of things from the de jure jurisdiction to the de facto jurisdiction. The U.S. Treasury is now the IMF. This, I tried looking up. I couldn't really piece that one. So there may be some truth to it. May not be. Another one that I also looked up that may not be there is the United States does not have any employees because there is no longer a United States, no more reorganization. After over 200 years of bankruptcy, it is finally over. Executive Order 12803. I didn't really find that. One that I also looked up was the FCC, CIA, FBI, NASA, and all other alphabet gangs were never part of the U.S. government, even though the U.S. government held stock in the agencies. There's two case laws that were pulled up, but even then, it was difficult to find that. Now, we have social security numbers are issued by the UN through the IMF. The application for a social security number is the SS5 form. The Department of Treasury issues the SS5 forms and not the Social Security Administration. The new SS5 forms do not state who publishes them, while the old form states they are Department of the Treasury. This one is a little askew. There are no judicial courts in America and have not been since 1789. Judges do not enforce statutes and codes. Executive administrators enforce statutes and codes. And there are two court cases that were put here, but pulling that up, there have been judicial courts after 1789. Up until the establishment of then bringing in the bar. That's my own research, though. According to GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, you must have a social security number. According to this would be a House report, meaning we have the House and we have the Senate. It is true to an extent that you need a social security number, but if you're from another country, you would have an ITIN. The You have New York City is defined in federal regulations as the United Nations. Rudolph Giuliani stated on C-SPAN that New York City is the capital of the world. For once, he told the truth. Excuse me, I didn't try. I did look into this a bit. I didn't really find anything on the reference to it. Social Security is not insurance or a contract, nor is there a trust fund. This is just not true. Okay. Social Security is not insurance. It is, though, a contract with the U.S. corporation to back up the debt of the United States. There is a trust fund. It's based on the credit of the United States. Your Social Security check comes directly from the IMF, which is an agency of the United Nations. It says U.S. Department of Treasury at the top left corner, which again is part of the UN, as pointed out above. Yeah, I don't receive a Social Security check, so I can't really say that. You own no property. Slaves can't own property. Read carefully the deed to the property you think is yours. You are listed as a tenant. Senate documents, 43, 73rd Congress in first session. It's not exactly there, but it is true. No one owns anything. The most powerful court in America is not the United States Supreme Court, but rather the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. This is true. The King of England financially backed both sides of the American Revolutionary War. Treaty of Versailles, which was July 16th, 1782, and Treaty of Peace, Title 8, Statute 80. Not true, because it was actually the satanic bloodlines that financed both sides of the revolution. You cannot use the U.S. Constitution to defend yourself because you are not a party to it. The U.S. corporation applies to the Corporation of the United States, a privately owned and operated corporation headquartered out of Washington, D.C., much like International Business Machines, Microsoft et al., and not to the people of the Sovereign Republic of the United States of America. Now, there's this case law of it. I don't believe I've found that case law, but it is true. You cannot use the U.S. Constitution, the original one, in court. Because the courts today are equity courts, meaning you need to use the Uniform Commercial Code in order to get things moving. Okay? Can't use the U.S. Constitution. And there's this thing going around where people think, like, oh, yeah, I just gotta stand in court, stand my ground, my rights, and I could do this. Yeah, I could do that all day long, and it'll take you years to finalize whatever case if you're able to finalize it. Whereas when you use the Uniform Commercial Code, that thing can get done that same day. Most of the time, cases are done through mail. Most of the time, not all the time. America is a British colony. The United States is a corporation, not a landmass, and it existed before the Revolutionary War, and the British troops did not leave until 1796. I also looked into this. Financially, it's owned by royalty. Financially, based on the wars, but that's about it. The Vatican owns Britain, Treaty of 1213. Yeah, there's no document on the internet that the Vatican owns Britain, but the Vatican owns all countries because of what are known as concordats. So I wouldn't say Treaty of 1213, rather they are called concordats. And this you can find. The Pope can abolish any law in the United States. Elements of ecclesiastical law. It's only true based on concordats that own corporate governance in the de facto, sure, just not the de jure. A 1040 form is for tribute aid to Britain. Yeah, pretty close. Pretty close, yeah. The Pope claims to own the entire planet through the laws of conquest and discovery. under papal bulls of 1495 and 1493. Yeah, I couldn't find that, as well as where it says the Pope has ordered the genocide and enslavement of millions of people. Couldn't find that either. I mean, don't get me wrong, you know, they want to do that stuff. The Pope's laws are obligatory on everyone. Apparently Benedict the 14th said this, as well as some other references. To an extent, they are, based on de facto jurisdiction. We are slaves, known absolutely nothing, not even what we think are our own, how are our children. And there's a few case laws talking about this. This is true because of the birth certificate. Okay, it's not the actual certificate of live birth. Certificate of live birth is held by the Vatican as the actual, since the copy of the certificate of live birth is held by then the state, then there's two birth certificates issued. There's the one issued to your parents and one issued to the Federal Reserve. Okay. So yes, everything is owned by the enemy, by the stuff that we've collected today. You have military George Washington divided up the states into districts. I looked this up. It's not exactly accurate. The people does not include you and me. Baron versus Mayor and City Council of Baltimore. Yeah, I was looking that up. I may have found it because I don't have it directly in front of me. It is not the duty of the police to protect you. Their job is to protect the corporation and arrest code breakers. This is absolutely correct. Police officers are private security. Sheriffs are the law enforcement of the Constitution for the Republic of the United States. Everything in the United States is up for sale. Bridges, roads, water, schools, hospitals, prisons, airports, etc., etc. Did anybody take time to check out who bought Klamath Lake? Executive Order 12803. Yeah, I couldn't really find anything on that one. We are treated as human capital. Executive Order 13037. The world cabal makes money off of the use of your signatures on mortgages, car loans, credit cards, your social security number, etc. That's not in Executive Order 13037, but that is true. As we are treated as human capital, that when you sign off for your mortgages, your car loans, credit cards, social security number, your taxes, and so forth, that's how then they access the credits to then pay themselves and then have you bring up those Federal Reserve notes for them to double dip. They double-dip the chip. The UN, United Nations, has financed the operations of the United States government, a corporation of the United States of America, for over 140 years. Yeah, the UN has not been around that long. U.S. Department of Treasury is part of the UN, and now owns every man, woman, and child in America. The UN claims to hold all of the land of America in fee simple. And no, they, because there's the Bureau of Land Management, BLM, which actually holds all land patents and land grants and all types of titles and deeds and so forth to the actual land. So you're going to have to check that out. Whoever discloses, uses, or compels the disclosure of the Social Security number in violation of the laws of the United States shall be guilty of a felony and, upon conviction thereof, shall be fined under Title 18 or imprisoned for not more than 5 years or both. 42 U.S.C. Section 408, subsection A, subsection 8. And then disclosure of Social Security number, it shall be unlawful for any federal, state, or local government agency to deny any individual any right, benefit, or privilege provided by law because of such individual's refusal to disclose his Social Security accounts number. 5 U.S.C. Section 552, subsection A. Well, being that's true, in the United States Code, it does say that no one can require you to provide your Social Security number. At the same time, it does say that you're required to provide it. Yes, it's so messed up. It is so messed up. They say one thing and then mean another. Or they mean one thing and then they mean another. Oh my goodness. Well, let's go ahead and go over this a bit. Because this is all actually something I'm going to cover as well. Okay. I'm going to pull up a couple different sections of the United States Code. So first and foremost, we have here one of the things that's going around with the state national movement is Title 8 of the United States Code, Section 1101, Subsection A, Subsection 22. The term national of the United States means A, a citizen of the United States, or B, a person who, though not a citizen of the United States, owes permanent allegiance to the United States. Okay, so even though when you correct your status being a state national or a U.S. national or national of the United States, okay, you have your rights and life restored, but you're still connected to the debt of the United States Corporation. Where there's also Title 8, the U.S. Code, Section 1401, Subsection A, person born in the United States of America, national and states. Okay. You also have a few other areas. And these few other areas that I'm going to bring up here, they're going to cause some questions. So, bear with me on this, because I have gone through it a bit. But this is where it's going to be very interesting for many of you. And why you truly don't have your rights and life as a U.S. citizen. And I'm going to provide one case law and the rest as United States Code. Okay, so you have Title 1 of the United States Code, Subsection 1, says words denoting number, gender, and so forth. Person means corporation, companies, associations, firms, partnerships, societies, and joint stock companies, as well as individuals. What? So if you say you're a person, you're a corporation. You also have Title 18 of the United States Code, Section 9, Vessel of the United States defined. The term vessel of the United States, as used in this title, means a vessel belonging in whole or in part to the United States, or any citizen thereof, or any corporation created by or under the laws of the United States or of any state, territory, district, or possession thereof. And I'm going to repeat that again. The term vessel of the United States, as used in this title, means a vessel belonging in whole or in part to the United States, or any citizen thereof. Vessel of the United States. Any citizen. But here is also what's interesting, because Title 28, the U.S. Code, Section 3002, United States is a federal corporation. You have Return Mail, Inc. versus United States Postal Service. Says, government is a person. What? Well, if a person is a corporation, and the government is a person, what? Because you have 26 U.S.C. 7701, subsection 30, subsection C, United States person is a domestic corporation. Wait, whoa, what? So government is a person is a corporation is a citizen. Hence why in America, in all caps name, is the legal fiction entity. What? Inconceivable. Yeah, it's so messed up. So messed up. I'm not going to even get into the point where you don't need to provide your social security number to a bank to open up a bank account, but you do at the same time. At that point, it's just more about educating those people. So, without further ado, I am going to call this as a break point before we move into a secured creditor and why a secured creditor is the way to go, having absolute protection in the de facto and the de jure jurisdiction. So stay tuned, everyone. Come right back. All right, everyone. We're going to go ahead and finish off with this last part for U.S. Corporation. And why being a secured creditor is the best way to go. Now, you do want to first become a state national. That way, you start the process moving forward of regaining your rights in life and know how to stand. But that does not mean you're disconnected from the debt of the U.S. corporation. So whenever you see the debt saying, look how many trillions of dollars in debt the United States is in, it's just the debt of the U.S. corporation. So here's why I'm going to prove being a secured creditor is the way to go. I'm going to prove it with the Department of Justice on their website that talks about it, as well as the Uniform Commercial Code. And what you need to do to get that done. And you could actually, if you want to, do this from a foreign country. So, first we're going to go over Uniform Commercial Code, which talks about it. It's UCC 9-207, rights and duties of a secured party having possession or control of collateral. I'm going to talk about subsection D, because there's subsection A, B, C, and D, okay? A, duty of care when secured party in possession. B, expenses, risks, duties, and rights when secured party in possession. C, duties and rights when secured party in possession or control. D, buyer of certain rights to payment. So this is why I'm going to say this is important. If the secured party is a buyer of accounts, chattel paper, payment intangibles, or promissory notes, or a co-consigner. 1. Subsection A does not apply unless the secured party is entitled under an agreement. 2. To charge back uncollected collateral or otherwise to full or limited recourse against the debtor or secondary obligor based on the non-payment or other default of an account debtor or other obligor on the collateral. And number 2, subsections B and C do not apply. So that's why I skipped over A, B, and C, because they don't apply to anything at all whatsoever. Because it literally says it right there. If the secured party is a buyer of accounts, chattel paper, payment intangibles, or promissory notes, or a consigner. 1, subsection A does not apply unless the secured party is entitled under an agreement. They're talking about how duty of care when secured party in possession does not apply. Then you have 2, subsections B and C do not apply. Meaning expenses, risks, duties, and rights when secured party in possession. That's letter B and letter C. Duties and rights when secured party in possession or control do not apply. So what does that mean? Well, when we go to the Department of Justice website, it says the government as secured creditor, even though it's not talking about the government at all in this document. It says, while reorganization is an important goal, this goal cannot be pursued by exterminating a secured creditor's property interest. Reorganization is not a holy grail to be pursued at any length. This is based on Matter of Rash, which is under the Fifth Circuit Court in 1994. And there's a few sections that talks about. You have how it defines issues and goals at the outset by asking these questions, such as, do you have a valid perfected security interest that is not subject to a bankruptcy avoidance power? What threat is posed to collateral values or your claim by, 1, the automatic stay, or 2, in the case of Chapter 11 or 13 from the anticipated plan? That basically means, what threat is posed to what you have based on you not being able to collect or filing bankruptcy or reorganizing your business from the plan you have created? Another question they ask is practical considerations for reorganizations. 1, is reorganization feasible? 2, is the debtor competent, honest, and cooperative? 3, how much collateral value is lost if the debtor is liquidated? And D, are there client policy interests besides maximizing recovery? Then it goes on to defining the secured interest. Talks about the sections for it. It also goes into adequate protection. She talks about 11 U.S.C. Section 361. There's your protection. Was 11 U.S.C. 361? Well, let's go to that. Let's see what that talks about. It's funny, too, because looking at... I'm actually going to mention this one quickly. Because I actually pulled this up. So, when I mentioned Title 28 of the United States Code, Section 3002, I didn't mention about Section 3003. So I'm going to mention that very quickly. Rules of construction. This is subsection C, effect on other laws. This chapter shall not be construed to supersede or modify the operation of Title 11. That's number one. Number two, Admiralty Law. And there's a few other things. But it's interesting how it cannot supersede or modify Title 11. And what did the DOJ just talk about in here? They just talked about adequate protection. Title 11, United States Code, Section 361. They can't, the U.S. corporation can't supersede or modify Title 11. They can't supersede the protections of a secured creditor. So we're going to go to Section 361, Case Administration. Okay. 361, Administrative Powers. I'm going to get that pulled up here in just a moment. Adequate protection. What is that? Oh my goodness. Adequate protection. When adequate protection is required under sections 362, 363, or 364 of this title of an interest of an entity in property, such adequate protection may be provided by 1. Requiring the trustee to make a cash payment or periodic cash payments to such entity, to the extent that the stay under section 362 of this title, use, sale, or lease under section 363 of this title, or any grant of a lien under section 364 of this title results in a decrease in the value of such entity's interest in such property. Number 2, providing to such entity an additional or replacement lien to the extent that such stay, use, sale, lease, or grant results in a decrease in the value of such entity's interest in such property. Or 3, granting such other relief other than entitling such entity to compensation allowable under sections 503b1 of this title is an administrative expense, as will result in the realization by such entity of the indubitable equivalent of such entity's interest in such property. What does that mean? It means you can't do anything against a secured creditor even when things go wrong. That's what that means. Who are the creditors? Well, the creditors, of course, are, you know, the enemy when they change things up. But it's when those that become a secure creditor, meaning they become foreign to the United States completely, but are still connected to the credit system. They have those protections. Adequate protection. Talks about the general consideration. Code sanctioned methods of providing adequate protection. The automatic stay. Automatic stay just means that a secured creditor cannot collect when the process is closing. That's what automatic stay is. Doesn't allow the creditor to move forward any faster than that process closing. There are some things that allow them to move forward, such as exceptions to the automatic stay. None of substance. If collateral is property of the estate, you are stayed from disposition of the property, even if you are in possession. 2. Commencement of a suit on behalf of HUD to foreclose a mortgage insured under the National Housing Act, which covers property consisting of 5 or more living units, is expected from the automatic stay. The section does not permit continuation of the action. All right. Talks about duration of the stay, talks about enforcement of the stay, obtaining relief from the automatic stay. Under obtaining relief from the automatic stay, there's also where you can file a motion rather than a complaint. Motions move the court, not complaints. Standards for obtaining relief. Time limitations, scope of the hearing, burdens of proof. Moving back to letter F, we have tactical considerations regarding the automatic stay. Back to letter V for number 5, use, sale, or lease of collateral. Talks about the general considerations. The creditor's protection is the right to demand adequate protection. Sales of collateral by the trustee free and clear of liens. Moving to number 6, you have secured creditor's lien may be demoted by the provision for obtaining credit. You have number 7, post-petition effective security interest. And this is why the secured creditor has the utmost protection in the de jure and the de facto jurisdiction, and why the U.S. corporation can't do a thing to prosecute the secured creditor, unless, for example, if there's fraud, you know, or unless there's some crime that there's a victim involved in. That's different. But now that you know the secured creditor has the utmost protection, I mean, I can go into full detail and reading everything on that page. But if you would like to look up the case laws and all the protections besides UCC 9-207, just go to the Department of Justice, which is justice.gov, G-O-V, and you want to look up Justice Manual. And under the Justice Manual, you're going to find the Civil Resources Manual. And it's going to be number 68, where it says the government as secured creditor. And that's where you're going to find that information on all the protection of the secured creditor. So, how do you become a secured creditor? Well, this is the corporate way to do this, not the actual way to do this. Meaning, the actual way to do this is has been changed. I'm not going to talk about how it was changed. We're going to talk about what you're able to do now. Because the way that it was changed, you can't use that anymore. I mean, you could from like a one-to-one, but to like from you to a business, that just doesn't work. So what you need is a foreign grantor irrevocable express trust that has its foreign EIN number. Usually it's a 98. So when it comes to any kind of trust, there's two numbers, a dash, and then you have a few other numbers, set of numbers. The two numbers with before the dash, that means the type, that means that's where the jurisdiction and where that creation of your number is provided the dash and the numbers after that is the identification number of your trust. Why do you want to have a trust to begin with? Well, because a trust avoids taxes. Okay, everyone who's wealthy has a trust. Even if you're not wealthy and you create a trust, you avoid taxes and you avoid probate. Now, there are a list of things that you need. Now, I'm able to help people in getting this put together. There's just one last part I'm finishing up with, which is part of the SEC side, the filing side. And this is the Securities Exchange Commission, because the SEC enforces commerce. Okay? So, the Secure Creditor Trust, besides you creating your trust, okay? You need a deed of transfer. You need a notification of record. You need a cover letter for Puerto Rico Secretary of Treasury. You need an order for deposit management and investments. You need security agreements. A hold harmless indemnity agreement. You need a common law copyright notice. You need to do a UCC 1 financing statement and financing statement addendum. You also need to do Form 56, which is for the U.S. Secretary of Treasury, as well as another Form 56 for the Puerto Rico Secretary of Treasury. You also need a W-8 Ben with affidavits. You also need to have a private registered bond for investment of $100 billion, which is your indemnity bond, or you can have $100 trillion, whatever number, okay? You also need the UCC-3 financing statement amendment, all right? As well as a legal notice and demand, you need affidavit of the parties and the relationship to all. You also need a commercial notice appointment of fiduciary debtor and creditor. You also need non-negotiable chargeback, as well as non-negotiable bill of exchange, RE, chargeback of UCC contract trust accounts. If you have your certificate of live birth, great. Not, you can still use your birth certificate either way. You also need to do a notice of lien, property attachments, durable power of attorney, actual and constructive notice, IRS Form 1040 ES, as well as for your tax, your power of attorney, meaning your CAF number, your power of attorney. There's two IRS forms as well. I just didn't have them written down. I can't think of the numbers at the top of my head. I believe one of them is 8828, if I'm not mistaken. But there's power of attorney IRS document as well as CAF number IRS form. They're both IRS forms. Now, with the SEC forms, okay, you need an EDGAR account, all right? And the reason why you need an EDGAR account is because most forms that are filed online. So you can have it printed out because you're going to have some of those notarized. But you want to have Form ID. Form ID is meaning you're letting the SEC know you're either a filer or filing on behalf of someone. There's a couple others, but those are the usuals. But besides that, you have Form 10, Form 40-APP, Form N-8A, Form 3. Oh, yes, you're also doing an amendment to the N-8A, as well as Form APPWD, Form D, Form N-18F1, Form ANS-15G, Commercial Security, Form F3, as well as the amended version of Form F3, and Form 1. That is what I have for the SEC documents. The reason for the SEC documents is so that way you're not caught up on fraud. Now, granted, there's people that have not filed the SEC documents, have not gone to prison or jail for fraud because they're just getting their bills paid, maybe getting car once here, once there, and that's about it. But when you're dealing with the credit system a lot, more than a few different times, having more than just your bills paid, yes. That's why you need to let the SEC know about it. And you also have to have form T-1 as well as T-2, which is technically called form 25. Technically. Somewhat yes, somewhat no. But the reason why I say T-1 and T-2 are because of, well, the Bank of New York Mellon SEC form that I found. I'm going to actually pull that up right now. I'm going to read that off. This is the last thing before I head out, though, so I can let you all know about this, because this is a very revealing document that showed me this is how they're able to manipulate the market without getting in trouble for it. It's so messed up. But it's how they're able to access people's credits so that way they get paid twice. Okay, so I have it pulled up here, which is form T-1. It's technically called form EX-25 or form EX-25. And this here is a statement of eligibility under the Trust Indenture Act of 1939 of a corporation designated to act as trustee. Okay. The Bank of New York Mellon. It's the name, exact name of trustee as specified in its charter, which says the Bank of New York Mellon. New York, jurisdiction of incorporation, if not a U.S. national bank. One Wall Street, New York, New York. Address of principal executive offices. IRS employer identification number 13-5160382. Zip code 10286. Under that, you have Bank of America Corporation. Under that says exact name of obligor as specified in its charter. And you have Bank of America. It says Delaware, state or other jurisdiction of incorporation or organization. Under that, you have its address, you know, Bank of America Corporate Center in North Carolina. IRS employer identification number 56-09066-09. Then there's a code. Under that, you have guarantees of trust securities of Merrill Lynch Preferred Capital Trust V for the number 5. Under that says title of the indenture securities. So that got me really, really, really interested. Because it talks about here, for example, a copy of the organization certificate of the Bank of New York Mellon, formerly known as the Bank of New York, itself formerly Irving Trust Company, as now in effect, which contains the authority to commence business and a grant of powers to exercise corporate trust powers. Then you also have A copy of the existing bylaws of the trustee, Exhibit 4 to Form T-1 filed with the registration statement, such consent of the trustee required by Section 321B of the Act. A copy of the latest report of condition of the trustee published pursuant to law or to the requirements of its supervising or examining authority. And then Francine Kincaid is a vice president, signed off on this. And you have consolidated report of condition of the Bank of New York Mellon. This is back in 2013. Back in 2013, this is talking about its assets. Dollar amounts in thousands. You have cash and balances due from depository institutions. You have non-interest bearing balances in currency and coin. $5,547,000. Interest bearing balances. $109,455,000. Securities. Held to maturity securities. $13,784,000. Available for sale securities. $87,504,000. Federal funds sold and securities purchased under agreements to resell. Federal funds sold in domestic offices, $119,000. Securities purchased under agreements to resell, $3,072,000. Oh my goodness. Securities purchased under agreements to resell? I wonder what that is. And you have loan financing, receivables. Loans and leases held for sale, zero. Loans and leases, net of unearned income, $31,852,000. Loans and leases, net of unearned income, less. Allowance for loan and lease losses, $199,000. Loans and leases, net of unearned income and allowance, $31,653,000. Trading assets, $5,889,000. Premises and fixed assets, including capitalized losses, $1,150,000. Other real estate owned, $3,000. Investments in unconsolidated subsidiaries and associated companies, $1,047,000. Direct and indirect investments in real estate ventures, zero. Intangible assets, goodwill, $6,412,000. Other intangible assets, $1,356,000. Other assets, $14,348,000. Total assets, $281,339,000. And then, of course, you have your liabilities, your equity capital in there. Yeah. But this is what got me interested. And so this is the way that you're able to remain in compliance in the de facto engaging in commerce is with the SEC and how it proves you can have a corporation as a trustee of a trust. So that just really makes it extremely interesting. So I want to leave that off with y'all as this has been awesome content I wanted to bring to you all. It's been over a month. Actually, it's been almost 2 months since I brought something. But this year, I wanted to bring out because I felt this needed to be brought. So till next time. You stay tuned. See you next time. Peace.